Welcome, everyone. I am your host, Robert Stark. I am joined here with Richard Spencer. He is the editor of a Radix journal and was the founder of the original Alternative Right, which he no longer runs now. Richard, it's nice having you on.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Robert.
So we'll cover some different news items and topics, but where I want to start off from is you probably get this question a lot. But what originally made you decide to quit the alternative right? Because I know that phrase, the catchphrase, it's really caught on, and it's been used as the terminology, the alternative right, has been used as a sort of catch-all phrase to describe a sort of fairly broad movement.
Yes, I certainly haven't quit the alternative right writ large. I simply felt that it was necessary to really get control of the properties that I'm associated with. And I mean, I'll just I'll briefly recount the story. I believe I might have coined the term alternative right. I might have heard it somewhere or other people kind of generated it together, but I was the one who tried to own it in a way. And in March of 2010, I actually created a website called alternativeright.com. And I'm very proud of everything we did there. And I edited that website passionately for 2 years. And, you know, when I started it, it was a bit of an experiment, and I wasn't even sure how it was going to turn out. But I was, you know, again, very proud with how it turned out. But at around March of 2012 or spring of 2012, I was a little bit burned out with the website, and I had started to work for the National Policy Institute and Washington Summit Publishers and other things. And I just felt like I had to go. But I also did promise people, oh, I'll keep this website live and things like that. And you know, Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki were continuing to post, and they really became very passionate about alternativeright.com. The only problem was that it was something that I kind of sort of owned. You know, I created the web architecture, I own the URL, and although I liked a lot of what was published, I didn't like all of it, to be honest. And I didn't like just the idea of being of alternative right always being associated with me and also MPI. And so last year, it was about a year ago, I kind of took everything back, and I wanted to really focus on something that I can control. And that is Radix, and Radix is a project of MPI, so it all kind of works together. There's Radix, there's Washington Summit Publishers, and there's MPI itself. And Colin and Andy, they went off on their own, and they're doing their own thing, and they've kind of used the term, they've used the title Alternative Right for their website. And to be honest, I find that fine. I've not trademarked the title. And so it lives on, and I think the term lives on as a catch-all for rightists in the United States and around the world who have very different assumptions from, say, the American conservative movement or mainstream so-called conservative parties in either United States or Europe. So I'm actually very happy that that term has taken on a life of its own. So yeah, I'm still part of the alternative right in that sense. But the original alternativeright.com is just an archive. It kind of, you know, I feel, you know, a little bit nostalgic about it. It was a very interesting time in my life, and I'm very happy with what we did.
Is part of the reason that you quit using that term is because the term right is linked with the American right? And you've kind of want to distance yourself from the label and the stigma of the right, and you're saying that you look more to Europe for inspiration as opposed to the American right.
Yeah, I think, you know, that is part of it, and you're bringing up a very interesting point that I think we'll definitely get to later in this podcast, and that is the baggage that sometimes we put on ourselves by associating ourselves with conservatism or the right wing, so on and so forth. And I also think that there's a big problem when you have a what I like to call a slide rule conception of left and right, where, and what I mean by that is that there's a continuum, a linear continuum from left to right. And so that goes from, say, Lenin or something to the far left, and then right in the middle we'll have, I don't know, Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan, and then to the very far right we'll have Adolf Hitler or something. And so from in this, you know, viewpoint or imaginary left-right continuum, you know, we're kind of like Ronald Reagan or Ted Cruz, but only more so, more intense, but maybe not as right-wing as Hitler or something like that. And I think all of that stuff, I think, really is just it masks things that are really important. I think it's not a very helpful way of thinking about our views or thinking about the world or thinking about ideology. I just think it's something that's kind of useless. And I think all these different left-right ideologies or political groups are part of a particular time and place. And oftentimes they'll call upon certain energies that might actually seem the opposite of what they are. Well, you know, there are very many communist groups. I'm thinking of Vietnamese communists, but there are many other examples who would, in a way, call upon nationalism and call upon ethno-nationalism.
Or there's national
as something that's
national Bolshevism.
Go ahead.
The movement in Russia that I don't know if Alexander Dugin still calls himself a national Bolshevik, but he was originally involved with them.
Yeah, that's another example. I mean, there's another example. And I don't even think that a party itself has to officially adopt a left-right hybrid ideology. I think that you can see this in its character. Interestingly, when the Soviet Union was invaded by Germany, the Operation Barbarossa, a lot of the rhetoric of communist was about defending the motherland, and it was a kind of calling back to something older and something more real. A lot of this, sorry, I might go off on a tangent here, but this is all very interesting. So much of what the Soviet Union did was actually inspire ethno-nationalism within its imperial structure. So you would have new nations were created, they were given a national poet and a national anthem, and there was a kind of multiculturalism or friendship of the peoples within an imperial structure. So again, that was calling on something that could be quote-unquote right-wing or traditionalist. So again, all of these, and again, just to go forward, I mean, in the United States, I think, you know, and effectively everyone's a liberal. there is a basic liberalism.
Well, it depends how you define liberal. I mean, your average person on the street thinks liberal means the left wing of the Democratic Party. But again, I mentioned Dugin. Dugin uses the word liberalism to sort of describe the system, basically the modern system of like globalization, Americanism, mass consumerism. So the word can mean different things
right.
to different people.
Right, without question. And what I mean by everyone's a liberal is that if you at the base of conservatism, you might have some, let's say, at the base of American conservatism, I should be specific, you have maybe some generic Christianity thrown in there, you have some interest in the military and national security or something like that. But it's, you know, if you really listen to their ideology, the way they articulate their understanding of the world and their understanding of themselves, it's fundamentally liberal. It's about, oh, you know, everyone should be able to do their own thing, and we live in a whole globe of universal rights, and America is not just a peculiar nation, it's a nation for all nations, so to speak, and, you know, every other nation will soon become American, blah, 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 blah. There's a certain strand of liberalism that is, articulated through so-called conservatism in America. So, you know, we're all liberals here, in a way. But again, I could basically go on all day about this stuff. The whole point that I'm trying to prove, and you know, there are hundreds of more fascinating examples. But the whole point that I'm trying to prove is that thinking about this left-right linear continuum is, I think, not very helpful. And I think it's something we really need to get away from. And we're going to if we're going to have a successful dynamic movement in the future, we're going to call upon a lot of things that many people might think are left-wing. We'll call on a lot of things that are right-wing from certain perspectives. But we can't really think like this. We can't desire to divide our people and our civilization, amongst a few hot-button issues and say that, oh, we're the right-wing or something like that. I think that's not going to be helpful, for us to build a successful movement.
So what I wanted to talk about is you did a podcast about the Republican victory in the House and Senate, and but I want to get to you touched on a comment and you touched on it very briefly, but I'd like to get into that more in depth. But before I get to that, can you just give our audience sort of a basic overview of your thoughts on the Republican victory?
Sure. I would say if I were to put it in a nutshell, it was definitely a discontent election, much like 2010, but it was also much, much more muted than 2010. 2010 was a very angry period, and I really didn't see that occurring in this last election.
So 2010 was when the Tea Party was founded.
Yes. Well, the Tea Party stretches back earlier. It stretches back to the Ron Paul movement, I guess, but it really got going in 2009. In 2010 was the Tea Party election. I just remember all these television commercials of candidates where they were firing guns and holding up rifles and riding on horses. I mean, literally, where there was one famous in Nevada where she had pictures of very other looking illegal immigrants, and I think she might even put them in a rifle scope or something. Maybe not that bad.
Sharon Engel?
Yeah, Sharon Engel did something very provocative that was kind of playing footsie with race and things like that. Oh, do you remember what she did exactly?
No, I don't.
Oh, she actually, I believe she might have put white children and then put like them in a crosshairs of a rifle. She did something. All I'm getting at is the stuff that was going on was highly provocative. Machine guns, horses, and screaming. I think that whole Tea Party moment is really over. I don't think the Republican Party is riding that wave anymore. And I don't think even the population is excited about this stuff. So that's basically how I viewed it. It was discontent, but
a typical referendum on that you see towards the end of a administration, like the Democratic victory in 2006,
yeah.
And then the Republican victory towards the end of the Clinton administration. It was at 96 or 98.
Yeah, well, it was actually 94. There was a kind of 2010 like referendum.
Oh, yeah.
But in 96, they actually lost some seats, if I remember correctly, and Newt Gingrich resigned. But that's how I see it. I mean, I think these presidents, as their terms go along, they usually run into difficulties. George W. Bush had a very low approval rating. I think it was, 9 and 10. Americans didn't like him very much. So in a way, Barack Obama is doing very well to be at the end of his term. And I think there's also a bigger demographic thing going on, and that is that just by the structure of our electoral system, the demographic transformation of the American nation is going to express itself in surprising ways. For one thing, I might very well be wrong, but I don't think the Republican Party as it is going to win very many more presidential, that is, national elections. I think it of course might happen, and it certainly could happen, but demographics have shifted to such a point that it is going to be very difficult. And again, a lot of that will be about issues or the economy, but it's really going to be overwhelmingly about the demographics of who we are, of particularly non-white immigrants, not identifying with the Republican Party. It's as simple as that. That being said, within that national change, there will certainly be many, many more opportunities for Republicans to hold statewide office, to get elected to Congress, and things like that. I mean, this whole country is going through a kind of big sort, where there'll be demographic pockets across the place. It's not like we have a equal distribution by any stretch. And so I think we'll actually see this pattern might keep going for another decade or more. And that is that Democrats are going to win the big prize. They're going to get the White House. They're going to feel like they're in control of the nation. But these Republicans and the white people who identify with the Republican Party are going to win these smaller elections. And I can see this as a status quo that might go on for another 10 years or so.
So this is the comment that you said, and as I mentioned, it's a very brief comment, but I'd like to get more into this because mm-hmm. it's very fascinating. But you talk about kind of creating a new movement. I mean, I don't want to use the word centrist, but let's say a radical centrist movement, if you will. But that incorporates certainly left-wing views. But what you said specifically is it's not – you talk about voters, especially millennial voters. It's not so much that they're in favor of things like mass immigration, but they link –
They're not.
No, but they link mass opposite. Yeah. They link like sort of – they see pictures of the protesters in Murrieta – and they kind of look at those people and they, even though they don't, they may sort of agree with them, they kind of like view them as like a bunch of a rednecks, or they associate opposition to immigration with the right wing of the Republican Party, or being anti-gay, being against gay marriage, yeah. or anti-abortion, or the evangelicals.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's a very tricky issue, and a lot of people look at millennials, it's such a left-wing generation, we hope they'll one day grow up and be conservatives, whoever isn't a liberal in youth doesn't have a heart and blah, blah, blah. Well, it's really not that simple at all. It's a much more complicated issue. And on things like affirmative action or mass immigration, those things have really never been popular, and they ultimately are not popular with millennials. And so you can actually get them. I mean, they are reachable. They know what's going on. It's not something they like. But I guess what I'm saying when I'm saying that we should be more, or an immigration reform, not necessarily we, but an immigration reform movement should be more centrist. I'm not saying that for ideological reasons. Like I'm an ideological moderate, which almost sounds like a contradiction in terms. What I mean by that is that I think we need to get rid of a lot of baggage that isn't helping us and that is really irrelevant. And a lot of this baggage that I don't think helping us really goes back to this whole thing of we're not left or right.
So no, you're not.
A lot of these baggage are things that are really intensely
sponsor gay pride parades.
No, we should sponsor other pride parades. But no, I'm not saying that. I don't think we should. What I'm getting at is I don't think we should really be obsessed about the homosexual issue either. I don't think that's going to be helpful because that's not really not what our movement is about. That isn't something we care passionately about. I'll get back to what I was talking about before. But I think I'm probably like a lot of people. I'm generally speaking pretty laid back about these issues. There's obviously a lot about the gay rights movement that rubs me the wrong way. It's not something that I would endorse, but it's also something that I'm pretty laid back about. Homosexuality has been a part of not just European culture, but it's been a part of world culture for millennia. It's not been a dominant or major part, but it has been there, and I don't think we're going to get rid of it. Homosexuality is not something that was invented in the 60s or something. It's been around a long time, and I think it's simply best to see it as such, and not to view it as some, you know, wonderful new thing that we should all endorse or something. But I think we don't need to be viewing this as, you know, gays are the enemy, or we need to reform them or pray they're gay away or something. None of that stuff is going to work, and that's not what our movement's about, and I just think we should get over it, to be honest. That's that whole issue. But hold on, let me go back real quick.
Okay.
I was on something. I want to finish it. So there are a lot of things that are very popular amongst certain groups that are really radically unpopular amongst the rest of the population. So if you think about those diehards who are still behind George W. Bush in the last year of his presidency, these are going to be older Americans. They're going to be overwhelmingly white Americans, but they're going to be older Americans who are still kind of believing and buying into all this, you know, let's go save the world or democratize the world at gunpoint. The American dream is still alive. You just need to work hard and wish upon a shooting star and everyone will be rich. This kind of Republican stuff, you know, Congress needs to have a special session in which we save Terry Schiavo from, you know, all this kind of stuff. That was in 2004, I believe. There's all of these issues, whether you're associated with very pro-war stuff, whether you're associated with the religious right and their issues and crusades, these kinds of things really aren't popular amongst the broad swath of people, and they're really not popular with the broad swath of white people, particularly young people. And yet these things are intensely popular amongst the older generation of people who are still voting Republican. And I think they're going to redefine the Republican Party for a while. I think we're going to have a lot more Ted Cruz's and Rick Perry's running for president. And so what I'm saying is that, you know, those people who are really into that stuff, who love the religious right, who love war, who want to, you know, wave the flag and democratize, you know, Muslims, that is not the future. That is the past. To put it in the bluntest of terms, those people won't be with us for much longer. So there is no reason why we should ever attach ourselves to those views. We aren't an intensification of Rick Perry and Ted Cruz. We just need to get away from that stuff. And if the immigration reform movement were to have a future, it needs to get away from that stuff. And what I was saying about the association in people's minds. Now, you and I who follow this stuff, we might know very well that Ted Cruz is not good on immigration. He might be quite bad at immigration.
Yeah,
so is Rick Perry.
So
are a lot of these Fox News.
Well, if you go on the website called Numbers USA, I'm sure you're familiar with it. Numbers USA, they rank the candidates on immigration. Out of the Tea Party guys, the only one who's actually I think Mike Lee is fairly decent on the issue. Mike Lee is, but the other ones like Ted Cruz are really not.
Yeah, they're not good. However, remember, perception is more important than reality in a lot of cases. And in people's minds, immigration reform is associated with all this stuff that has nothing to do with it. It's associated with not wanting to support the environment. It's associated with opposing abortion. It's associated with the religious right. It's associated with going to war, despite the fact that George W. Bush was terrible on the immigration issue. It's associated as a right-wing issue.
Yeah, like
if
you listen to Bill Maher, I mean, I listen to his show. Bill Maher does that. Like, when he speaks to his audience, he'll associate the being anti-immigration with being pro-war. Being anti-worker, being homophobic.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and so you know, if, again, I this might be our next topic, but I think we actually need to move beyond the immigration reform movement. But taking a step back, if the immigration reform movement wants to have a future, it's got to get away from being associated with the right wing. And so I said this, and my tongue was in cheek, but I'm really not joking to a degree. The brightest hope for the immigration reform movement is not to do some engage in right-wing shenanigans like impeaching Barack Obama or whatever. The future of the, if the immigration reform movement is going to have a future, it would be about a candidate who is okay with gay marriage, who's secular, who is anti-Wall Street, who's anti-war, and is a kind of moderate liberal, and someone who says, like, look, we've got to get this under control. Don't you want a country that your grandchildren can enjoy, that looks like the country we have now and the culture? That kind of moderate rhetoric would probably win. And that, you know, it's like you've got to go with the future and not with something that's the past. And all that right-wing stuff, all that Fox News nonsense, Rush Limbaugh stuff, that is the past. And we've got to run away from it. We, you know, the immigration reform movement and our movement, we don't need any of that baggage. We've got to get over it. We've got to present our new ideas. We've got to present our future-oriented ideas. Because if you're, you know, like the general that's fighting last year's war is going to lose this year's war. We need to get out in front and start really thinking about, you know, where the people of the future, the people who are going to be with us for the next, you know, 50, 75 years, you know, what are going to be their concerns? We've got to start thinking about that now. And, and from my perspective, go ahead.
Yeah, you bring up an excellent point, because I want to explain where I'm coming from. And I think where I'm coming from describes a pretty large demographic. But I'm someone who is culturally, I mean, I'm culturally kind of a swipple. I mean, I go to Whole Foods, I eat sushi, I'm an artist, I go to art galleries, so I have little in common with, like, the rednecks who are into NASCAR and WWE wrestling. Yeah. And the other thing is I have a lot of left-wing political views on the social issues like homosexuality. I'd say pretty moderate, but I'm pro environment. I'm anti Wall Street, so I have a lot of left wing political views. So I'm someone who stereotypically might be viewed as a liberal. But the reason that I'm sort of involved and sympathetic to the alternative right and the new right is because I witnessed the whole destruction of the white middle class in Southern California. And also the other big issue is the economics, and I'm seeing that for young millennials, there's not a lot of economic opportunities. So I'm describing myself, but I think I'm describing a fairly large political demographic, especially I'd say like young white millennial men who are not necessarily – who are, I'd say, but from – middle to upper middle class background, not the stereotypical right wing demographics like rural rednecks. I mean, first of all, I mean, I'm from Los Angeles, so I'm from a big city, so I don't fit into the sort of stereotype of the reactionary right. But I think there's a lot of people out there like me, but they feel like they don't have a voice.
Yeah, without question. I mean, I'm a lot like you. I could probably be described as a hipster of sorts. And I have a lot of your views, particularly living or spending most of the year where I do. I really care about the natural world. I mean, the notion that, you know, in the name of capitalism or something, that we're going to have a small world that's covered in cement and all you can see are strip malls far and wide. I mean, I find that horrifying. I think that protecting the natural world should be one of our chief priorities. I think that's more important than money or economic freedom or what have you. I have a lot of those views. I mean, I would say that someone would probably describe me as a hipster before they describe me as a redneck. That being said, I think I, you're I actually, probably like me. I mean,
lived,
I'm, I'm,
Well, I live somewhere. Yeah, like right now I live in Santa Barbara, which is very liberal, and I mean, I actually really like it here, but I lived in a place that was much more conservative, a town called Clovis, California. It's sort of a middle class town on the outskirts of Fresno, which is very conservative, and I felt totally out of place there.
Yeah, I mean, I what I was about to say is that I do feel comfortable around. Again, when we say redneck, we should put that in quotes because it's pejorative. But you know, people who are maybe from a more rural environment or kind of earthier. I mean, I'm very comfortable around such people. I would much rather I would be fine living amongst them. I would much rather live with them than say live with another race or another culture. But you know, I know who I am as well. Like I gravitate to stuff that's more, you know, a little more hipsterish. You know, I gravitate towards you know, wanting to go to a big city and wanting to, you know, walk around and visit a coffee shop and go hear a symphony or something. Or I kind of like being out here in the Pacific Northwest where, you know, things are I don't know, there is a kind of nice atmosphere, kind of green atmosphere, maybe a little hippie atmosphere. I kind of like that. I like being where you can just kind of walk out and see nature and you know, again, just a laid back kind of way, a place that generally speaking, despite some of the things I'm going through right now, actually, but generally speaking, has a live and let live attitude. I mean, that's kind of who I am. And so yeah, I mean, again, that I have always been just turned off by the religious right. I mean, I just have to be frank. I can remember things about them. I mentioned the Terri Schiavo affair and others. Just that whenever they do something in an organized fashion, I just turn aside. I don't find what they do to be in good taste. I find what they do to not really share my sense of life. And my sense of what I would want, the kind of world I would want to live in, the kind of future I want to have. I really don't have anything in common with Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson or all these people. I think I probably have more in common with Rachel Maddow than I do with Pat Robertson. So, you know, I'm not alone when I say this. And so you know, I just think our movement needs to drop the baggage of all this right-wing stuff, particularly in America. And I think if immigration reform is to have a future, it's got to drop the baggage too.
Yeah, because immigration links to those other issues. It's bad for the working class. It's destroying the environment. I
Right.
mean, and it's
Yes.
another thing is it's sort of the stereotype that people who move to the suburbs are all like white Republicans, but you look at a lot of these really horrific tract housing going up in Southern California and the Bay Area, and a lot of it is most of it's caused by mass immigration.
Wow. Yeah, I don't doubt it. You know, one thing that I've experienced is the transformation of Virginia. Northern Virginia, I mean, I used to live in Northern Virginia. I'm still there quite a bit, many times during the year. You know, Northern Virginia used to be a place that had a certain genteel quality. It was a place of green rolling hills. It was a place that kind of had some echoes of the old South and the Civil War. I mean, it is now one big concrete Applebee's. I mean, you can drive for miles. You don't know where you are. Everything looks just like it did 10 miles ago. It's just, I mean, I have to be honest, it's just awful. It is a bunch of chain stores connected together with highways. And, you
And a
know,
lot, you know
that's
what,
not the country I want to. Yeah, go ahead.
a lot of conservative Republican types thinks that's fantastic.
I don't want to live in a world like that. I want to live in a world where there's character and places are different. I mean, it's why I actually kind of, you know, I don't want this to seem like I'm some haughty hipster who hates rednecks or something. Like, I want, you know, I want people to be themselves, and I want there to be real differences where You know, you go to a big city, and then you can go to a rural place, and it has its own character, maybe its own way of talking. I think that's really great.
You could say it's
And so,
real diversity.
Yeah, real diversity, not this bullshit diversity that people promote, which is basically everyone has different skin colors, but they're saying the same thing, and we're all equal. You know, people don't realize as well, equality and diversity are opposites, effectively. I mean, you know, for there to be real diversity, there's difference, you know, and, you know, not everyone's equal. There's going to be different, you're going to have different backgrounds, different histories, different desires, different ideals, different ways of seeing the world. I mean, that's real diversity. And that's the kind of stuff that you and I want as liberal fascists that we are.
Yeah.
I say that jokingly. Just I hope someone doesn't record that. But
yeah, I'm a liberal fascist.
Yeah, I.
But back to what you were
saying. Right. Well, Jonah Goldberg might call us a liberal fascist. Yeah.
He would. He definitely would. I take that as a badge of honor from him. But anyways, you were talking about building a movement, and the thing is, it's important to build a movement that tackles all these issues. I think people who want to build a movement just on immigration, they're going to basically go the way of the Know Nothing Party. You have to have a holistic approach. You have to address all these issues. We talked about the environmental conservation issues, which are very important. Obviously, the key issue is the economy, because you have a lot of millennials coming up, and they're graduate. And these are people who are well educated, and these are people we need to attract. But they have, I mean, a lot of them, they're broke, living at home. Some of them, they have jobs as baristas. Some of them are unemployed, and they have like $100,000 in debt. So I think tackling economic issues is the key, is very important. And obviously, sort of like the right wing, like Reaganomics, or what the Tea Party is advocating, those Tea Party people, they're not. It's a geriatric movement. That's why you don't see any millennials in the Tea Party. And so if you want to build a broader
Well, also, it's a bunch of people.
If you want to build
a bunch
broader,
of people on Social Security.
Yeah.
Well, let me say this. It's a lot of people on Social Security and Medicare who want to talk about free market capitalism.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absurd at some level. You know? I mean, anyway, just telling the you have to just work hard and wish upon a shooting star and you'll be rich. I mean, you know, again, tell that to someone who's working at the Gap with $100,000 and university debt. I mean, it's just nonsense. So yeah, I mean, I think the economic issues are without question important, but I don't think that the whole thing. And I think you were actually getting at something earlier when you said that we need a holistic movement. And I would say that, you know, I have always been, let's say, tangentially connected to the immigration reform movement, in the sense that I've known people who have dedicated their lives to it. I've written about it a lot. I've attended some of their conferences. I've written for some of their publications, and so on and so forth. But I think, as I wrote in a blog, I think the immigration reform movement was really doomed, and I think it never really had a soul. And I mean that in a very serious way. I think the immigration reform movement in America has always been about numbers. You know, you see the names of the organizations, Numbers USA or Carrying Capacity. It's all about quantitative things. And it's all about also, oftentimes, it's also about kind of legalistic things. So, you know, it's illegal immigrants, or now one of the major criticism coming from Ted Cruz and all these phonies is, you know, what Barack Obama did was unconstitutional or something like this. Even though, of course, they supported all of these unconstitutional, quote-unquote, stuff that George W. Bush did. Apparently now they're...
By saying that, you're still giving the system legitimacy. By saying that, you're giving the system legitimacy. The best way is to take an outlook that the system is illegitimate.
Yeah, I think that is, I think that's part of it. But again, you know, immigration is not about, it's not ultimately about numbers. I mean, numbers are important, but it's not really about numbers. It's not about quantity, it's about quality. And it's not about law. You know, I mean, I mentioned this at a American Renaissance meeting. You know, what would happen if, you know, 100,000 South African Boer boat people washed up on our shores? They were fleeing, you know, a collapsing South African state, and they somehow ended up in America. Would we say, ah, these illegal immigrants, let's get them out of here, let's put them in jail and deport them back to, you know, some hellhole? No. I would say, you know, we need to give these people a home. And I would say that because I know that they would actually enrich our culture and environment. I mean, again, immigration is not about numbers and it's not about law. It's about who we are and who we want to be. It's not about quantity. It's about quality. It's about who we want and who we want to be. And that's what it's about. It's about who wants to be part of this family. And so, you know, I think for immigration reform to have a soul, it's got to be that kind of holistic thing that you were talking about. You know, race is a part of that, but race isn't the only thing either. I think there's some other idea. There's the environmental idea about, you know, we don't want every single white person living in one country. I mean, you know, we want to have a beautiful place that our grandchildren can enjoy. Our grandchildren can go to Yellowstone Park. Our grandchildren can go to San Francisco and appreciate it as a fascinating city and not some kind of third world hellhole. You know, this is the way we should think. We should think holistically and organically. And I think that the immigration reform movement really never thought like this. It never had a soul. It was about numbers. It was about legality. And going forward, we're going to really have to think holistically because, you know, from my standpoint, I think the immigration reform movement is totally over. I think it is irrelevant. I mean, they have been gearing up for an amnesty battle for as long as I can remember. Not, you know, it's been in the news for the last 2 or 3 years, but, you know, again, you can go back to 2007, you can go back to Bush, I think it's 2002 or 2003, you can go back earlier. They have been gearing up for this big amnesty battle. And granted, Barack Obama did it in using executive authority, and some might think that's illegitimate. But the fact is, he won. I mean, I don't see any outrage in the country over this bill that, you know, we're now living under a dictatorship or tyranny due to Barack Obama. I don't think anyone thinks that. They think he could have done it through Congress, but the fact is, they ultimately think that it was a lot of people. Or don't think that it was totally illegitimate. And so the immigration reform movement has been gearing up for this battle, and they lost. But I think they've even lost in a much deeper way, and that is that as of the summer of 2011, the majority of births in the United States are non-white. They're to non-white mothers with non-white children. And so the goose is cooked. I mean, we could conceivably stop all immigration tomorrow morning, and the demographic change of America would nevertheless take place. Whites would not be a minority in, say, 2050 or 2042, which I think is the year that they're using now. They might be a minority in 2065 or 2070, but who cares? It just, you know, the goose is cooked. And yeah, maybe you want to stop the bleeding or something, but, you know, that's not the ultimate answer. The ultimate answer is going to be something much different, much more radical, much more future oriented. And, you know, we need to start thinking about that now. We need to start thinking about, you know, how is the white race and Western and European civilization, how is that going to flourish in the future? What do we want, you know, the day after tomorrow? Because, you know, tomorrow, we'll wake up tomorrow morning, everything's going to be the same. The status quo is going to limp along for another who knows how many decades. But what do we want? What is that kind of utopian city on a hill, so to speak, that we want in the future? Where do we want to go? And I really think that we need to start thinking about that now. We need to stop focusing on immigration. That battle is over. That movement, it just didn't work. We've got to start thinking more radically. We've got to start thinking things that really we've been afraid to think before. And we've got to start to do that now. We've got to, you know, we've got to think about also about how we are going to act as a minority. And, you know, let me tell you, don't think 2050 or 2042 when, oh, we're officially going to be 49% and 51% will be other races or something like that. That's not the way to think about it. This is going to happen sooner. You know, I don't know, you know, I can't tell the future, but we're going to have a very different consciousness. We're going to have to think about the world differently very soon. Because we're going to start feeling like a minority a lot sooner than 2042. And we're going to have a different consciousness. We're going to have a different value system. We're going to have to get away from a lot of this, you know, right-wing kookery. You know, we are the American people and, well, you know, all this kind of – we've got to get away from that kind of stuff. And we've got to start to think about something new, and that is, how are we going to survive, and how are we going to even flourish, and how are we going to sustain our civilization and the ideals that we hold? How are we going to do that as a minority in the United States and in other European nations as well? And that is a huge challenge. I don't have all the answers for it, but I do know that we've got it. We desperately need to start thinking about that right now.
And none of those so-called like white nationalist types, they don't want to talk about it. They have a very like all or nothing attitude. Yeah, we're gonna get our ethno state all or nothing. We're gonna get our ethno state up in the Pacific Northwest. But I think that's really, I mean, I think those types are really immature. I think people need to think about how to thrive successfully as a minority, and look at groups that are successful minorities. And because you're not going to get everything, that kind of all or nothing attitude is foolish. People need to learn how to thrive in a multicultural society if they have to.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the ethnostate, and that is a state based on our whole civilization, a European Union, so to speak, but obviously one that's different than the one we have now. A new Roman Empire. All of these are big, bold ideas, and they are definitely inspiring. But we've got to be idealists, but we've also really got to be realists. I mean, if someone tried to create a revolution in some Pacific Northwest town, it's just, that would be a disaster. That would be a failure. We would set back everything we're thinking about and fighting for. You know, then it's just not, we don't have that opportunity now. I mean, yes, there are a lot of cracks in the current system. Yes, the United States power, I think without question, the United States is waning as a geopolitical hegemon, but it ain't over. And, you know, we've got to be very patient, and we've got to think about what we want. I mean, we don't even fully know what we want yet. We've got to think about it. We you know, we're in a position a lot like, say, Jews who were interested in Zionism in the 19th century, or say, Marxists who were interested in communism in the 19th century. We're in a point where we don't really know what we want yet. We don't know what historical opportunities will be there. We don't know when a real opportunity for radical change will be there. We don't know any of this stuff. We are in a kind of mode where we need to think about these things. We've got to make contacts. We've got to make friends. We've got to survive first and foremost. We've got to think about, how are we going to be a flourishing people in a multicultural, multiracial environment, one that will be hostile towards us in many ways, but one in which I have no doubt we can survive and flourish if we have the right consciousness. This is where we are. We're not, you know, revolution. That kind of stuff. It is. I'm afraid it is rather childish. It's kind of people playing a few too many video games. That's not where we are. And we've got to, if you know, our great great grandchildren, if the day after tomorrow, if they're gonna live in a better and brighter world, a world of real diversity, or a world where we might have something that, a kind of new order that adheres to our greatest ideals. if we're going to ever have that, we've got to be a hard-nosed realist now, and we've got to understand the hand that was dealt us, and we've got to play that. And we're not going to play some hand that we, you know, dream up, you know, in our dreams. You know, we've got to be hard-nosed realist. We've got to be hard-nosed idealist. I think that's the best way of saying it.
So, Richard, I'm going to wrap up the show pretty soon. Is there anything else you'd like to add about our earlier topic about building a new coalition?
I think I just mentioned it. I think a lot of it is just about making friends and meeting up and seeing that we have a lot more in common than we might think. I know there's a kind of debate going on in terms of ethno-nationalism and European nationalism. Obviously, I'm not on the side of rigid ethno-nationalism and dividing the white race or things like that. But I think that we've really got to talk to each other. We've got to make contacts, and we've got to see how much common ground that we really have. And we've got to think about how we have all these opportunities to meet, to strategize, to talk about what we want in the future than we ever had before. And so I would say that I think that's what we should be doing now.
Well, Richard, that was Richard Spencer. I'd like to thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Robert.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.